Hello and welcome back to the Let's Get Wicked podcast, where we talk about nothing but the game Villainous by Ravensburger. I am your host, Joker Jonesy, and I am joined by my lovely co-host, Headmaster Ditto. Ditto, I'm probably going to ask you now, for the rest of the time that we do this show, are you drinking coffee, and what coffee are you drinking?
I'm still drinking the same Kirkland brand from before.
Oh, come on now. You gotta switch it up, man.
I plan to. I do plan to. I've ordered some new stuff. It was actually on pre-order last week, so this hadn't even really been publicly released yet.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure exactly when it's going to ship, but I'll let you know when it does.
Okay. So, I like how you have to pre-order coffee or tea or whatever. I think that's hilarious.
No, it's like a brand new company. So, I'm surprised I found it. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
brand new startup offering pre-orders on their product, and I thought, sure, why not? I'd kind of been following it for a little while because they'd actually planned on doing all the pre-orders and stuff way earlier, but then, you know, pandemic. So
yeah,
here we are.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they were talking about how one of them got the Instagram advertisement spiel where they got advertised these like vegan nuggets, and it's like from a startup company, but like they released patch notes on their nuggets.
Where
like there's like 1.1 or 1.2 or I think it's like 1.6. So I was just like, chicken nuggets are an application now?
See, that actually makes me curious because I saw something from these people like just earlier today that was an update on the production process that was in the form of patch notes. I wonder if that's just a thing now.
That is hilarious. I can't believe we live in a time where food is getting patch notes.
It's so funny.
Oh my god. But speaking of patch notes, not really. Horrible transition. We have a very interesting show. It is just me and Ditto today. Classic Joker and Ditto conversation. I'm looking forward to this.
It's going to be good.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Probably like, we're going to mention that Kingdom Hearts music game that got announced, right, in this podcast at some point.
Talk to me about that rhythm game. that is the last thing I expected out of Kingdom Hearts, and I'm not going to say I dislike it.
Anyway, podcast with a podcast. We are doing a very interesting topic where we are going to be talking about the engine of Villainous as a game. Now, for those of you who don't know what we mean by that, Ditto, do you want to explain what an engine is, since we both come from programming backgrounds?
I can let you do it. You're the one.
You want me to do it? All right.
Go for it.
So the best way to describe an engine, especially for those of you who might not be as familiar with the programming side of things, some of you folks probably have played some video games before that when you boot the game up, they'll like say like some type of software that was used, whether it's like Unreal, Unity, Havoc, Scaleform, stuff like that. The thing is, all your games and all your applications run off of an engine, and that engine is meant to do very specific things. And that engine sometimes needs to be broken a little bit in order to do something unique. And that's what a lot of different video games do. Without getting too into the details, games like Guilty Gear and all the Mortal Kombat and Justice games actually work off of a very heavily modified engine of Unreal 3, which is completely outdated at this point. But what they did was they took an engine and they modified it, broke it down, and built their own little thing. Or other companies, well, they'll use these engines, and that's how they build their games. And with Villainous here, we're going to be talking about identifying all the different parts of the game that kind of, you know, show the design philosophies that the developers had in mind while they were working on this game. This is kind of a cool conversation because not only is it going to help, you know, those of you who are making customs kind of identify some, you know, common things that you're going to see as like mechanics in the game, but it's also going to help those of you who are kind of like super competitive meta side. Because like for me personally, it's kind of cool to break down the engine to help kind of identify play styles of different villains and actually like say that Villainous has these archetypes of characters. While in the custom scene, you can kind of use that as a way of like, all right, if I know my character is going to be using these types of mechanics, I should probably be looking at the engine in this particular line of eyeballs. That's what I, that's how I would go about.
Exactly. To use another analogy that I would kind of describe it as for people who are maybe less game oriented, you have the engine in your car that allows it to move forward. That's basically the same thing here. We're looking at the mechanics and structure that the game offers to us that runs the game. Basically.
Without that, it can't run.
Exactly. Otherwise, it would just going to be a pile of assets just kind of sitting there. It's like, all right, well, what are we doing with this?
Exactly. So let's go ahead and try to break this down a little bit, Ditto. We'll kind of start with the more, I would say, kind of basic universal stuff, and then we can kind of get a little bit more into the details.
That's fair.
I would say, you know, the game at its core is a hand management game. Can we concur on that?
I would probably expand it a little bit to just generically card management more than hand management.
Okay, card management. I agree.
Because there's just as much reliance on location and positioning the cards on your board even after they're played.
Right, you're absolutely right. Absolutely.
So definitely a card management game. Yeah. Not necessarily a like a strict card game, just because of all the two-dimensional pieces that are involved. But card management.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't completely understand what that means, is that granted, that's what the term is essentially you as a player have to think about how you're going to be using those cards throughout the entirety of the game. Like, are you going to be discarding this card, playing this card to this location, using this card in this particular way? That's what makes why the game is labeled as a strategy game, because literally card management is all about how you're going to be using those cards in that particular time when they're in your hand or if they're in the board, like all that stuff. That's what this game is. So, and that's with every villain too. So even though all the villains have different goals, you know, and like, yeah, there's different categories of the goals and how they play, but at the core, each of the characters has to have some sort of card management. That is how they essentially work in order for them to feel like a villainous villain. I think we can all agree on that front.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd almost be willing to extrapolate it further into basic resource management, just based on the power and like poison, trust, etc., whatever have you, counters that other characters have. I think just generic resource management is a good category for it.
Yeah, worker placement is something. I don't think it's a worker placement game, but it definitely has that little nice, like, sting of it where, like, when you're moving your character around, like, you're moving to that location and taking actions at that location, but like, you as the player are making that decision on like where to go to make the actions to card manage your hand or your realm or whatnot. So there's also that aspect of it too.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
I think this game is probably the closest I've seen to, like, a board game RTS, almost.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Which, again, is a category of resource-managing type of video games that adapts really well here.
Civilization, Age of Empires, stuff like that. If you want to even go further, all your sim, like, building games, like your tycoon games, like Roller Coaster Tycoon, Railroad Tycoons, all those games.
Minute Coaster, all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, no, same boat. I've always told people, like, I've always related this game to thinking, like, it's like a Civilization game or an Age of Empires game. I've always told people that.
It has that kind of structure to it. You can definitely approach it with that kind of mindset.
Yeah, I'm glad. You know, this is why you and I get along so well, because we both realized that, and I didn't have to tell you that. It's great. So, that's the game at its core. Now, each villain has a realm, four locations, and those four locations have actions on them. Overall, these actions are, you know, I can list them all, but it's play a card, gain power, discard stuff, move a hero, move a card in the realm that's that belongs to you, and activate. Those are all the actions.
Yeah, we pretty much know the drill at this point.
Yeah, we know the drill. Now, how those actions are placed in the realm, I actually think is a huge part of the engine of this game a little bit, that I think is very important. And one of the things I want to talk about is kind of like each villain has a relatively similar setup realm in their in some of their locations. Things change a little bit based off of the, I would say, the goal and the cards that they have in their hand. I think the only thing that is truly universal with each villain is that every single villain has at least the three power at the bottom, as well as a card play at the bottom as well of their one of their locations. Wherever that location is, who knows?
I don't know if it's every...
Yeah, I think it is, because even Prince John, because even though Prince John doesn't have the dual play card with the three, he still has the play card with the three at the bottom at the jail.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Just I could have sworn there was somebody with two twos, but I may be misremembering something.
No, I don't think there is. No. There's definitely one that doesn't have a two. We know who that one is. Yeah.
That one location that he's talking about is the one that's usually three power, play a card, second play a card at the top, and then that last action is usually some utility based on what the character likes to be able to do anyway. Usually it's either a move or a discard, I want to say, for a lot of characters.
Yeah, there's a few characters that have activates. Queen of Hearts and Jafar come to my head.
The ones that have activates there are the ones that really do, like, heavily need activates to win. Except for Cruella, weirdly enough.
Which is funny.
Yeah, she's a bit weird.
Yeah. The three power location is always the place where I like to call the combo spot, where you gain a lot of money and then you can play a lot of cards, and then you also gain that, like what Ditto was saying, the utility. Most of the characters have a discard at that location, but characters like Cruella, Jafar, Queen of Hearts, Captain Hook, characters that have like more actions that they want to use to kind of manipulate the cards that are in their realm, per se. I mean, sometimes their hand, depending on what that type of character is. That's usually what that's there for. I know some players might think, like, why isn't the discard action at every single one of those locations? And it's mainly because I don't think it's necessary for every single character. I think Dr. Vassilier is a really good example of this, where his combo spot has a move action at the top. And you wouldn't necessarily think that the move action is, like, a big deal. But in Dr. Vassilier's realm, you want to move stuff a lot, honestly. Like,
without a doubt. Like, this is where it starts getting into the really fun analysis of this game, is like the benefit analysis of each one of the individual actions.
Right.
Obviously, Facilier is a character that really benefits from moving stuff around consistently. Cruella benefits from moving stuff around pretty regularly. Captain Hook, to an extent, is really good about that. Pete, to an extent, is really good about moving stuff around.
Right.
And you notice these is we're just going down the list of the ones that have the move action at that location.
Yeah.
That three power location pretty much across the board is going to be your main, like, you're going to be bouncing here regularly.
Yeah.
Between being able to play cards and getting some benefit out of them instead of just discarding them, and the extra power you could save, and the utility of that extra action is probably going to be something you want. Like, that's going to be a location you go to a lot.
Yeah. And even if you do have to, so, like, if the player has the discard action there, there's a reason for that. Like, just to bring him up, like, Hades, for example. Like, Hades needs to gain power, and he needs to kind of dump cards to get the stuff that he wants. So it's a really solid time to just go over there sometimes, gain your three power, maybe play a really heavy card, and then just chuck a bunch of stuff. That is still a very big power play with the character, you know? Yeah.
Basically, 101 for all the custom designers. Whatever action you put at the game three location, that is going to be the main. This is your main strategy.
Right. That's like the core
thing. That's what you're going to be building your strategy around, is that one action. So make it count.
Yeah. Going along with the other locations, I'm going to save one of them for last, and it's that one's actually kind of interesting, but I actually want to talk about the fate locations next. And the reason is because, so each realm has two locations that have a fate. One of them is at the top, one of them is at the bottom. And one of the things that's pretty consistent amongst all of the villains is that one of the locations has this combination of actions. Now, where they are, if they're on the bottom or the top, is kind of a mix, and it kind of depends on the character. But there's always one that has play a card, gain one power, discard, and fate. I like to call this spot the reset spot, where essentially the player is kind of like in a weird situation where they don't really know what to do, and they kind of have bad cards, or they have not enough power to play cards that they need to do. And they go here, they basically gain a little bit of money, they can kind of chuck some bad stuff in their hand, and then they can fate. So even though they might not necessarily be moving towards their goal, they're trying to at least stall their opponent a little bit to, you know, change the pace of the match.
And it's worth remembering that that reset spot doesn't always have the one power.
That is true.
But the fate, discard, and play combination is very, very common. And that kind of comes down to a design thing that I've kind of kept in mind, where you always want to make sure that there's at least a play available at a location, even if it's coverable.
Right.
That way you don't always feel like it's completely worthless, cough, cough, palace. but, yeah. Like, in the Queen of Hearts, for example, it's not a gain power. It's the Vanquish it told you would.
Right.
Because, again, you're not going to be vanquishing as the Queen of Hearts that often, so you're kind of only going there to fix a bad situation.
Basically. Exactly. And especially with her, like, she has such a decent power gain that even going there to vanquish something is still kind of a reset for her. You know what I mean? Like,
to an extent, like, if you've been holding on to Very Merry on Birthday, or if you want to try to get an extra guard down and get set up for a pocket watch.
Right.
Play later. I mean, you can turn a zero power location into something pretty strong still.
Right.
Absolutely. Even if that vanquish is a little bit wasted.
I'm trying to think if there's any other character, because I think Queen of Hearts is like the only super outlying member, because even Jafar still has that, like, those set number of actions at that location.
I believe Scar's Gorge is set up the same way that told you.
But he has the Savannah.
Yeah, he has the Savannah as the reset, but
that's because the next thing I was going to get at is that the other fate location usually has something that allows the player to still go towards their goal.
It's the utility location.
Yeah, like with Scar, like what you point out with Scar, like the Gorge doesn't gain you any power, but it allows you to move something, which can come into play with vanquishing stuff with shenanigans with Stampede. You can play the card, so that allows you to play Stampede or some extra allies and move them around and stuff. Vanquish, which Scar's whole thing.
Vanquish, yeah.
And then Fate. You know, it's all solid stuff.
And that really comes to a head, again, kind of with the Queen of Hearts, because her other Fate location in the White Rabbit's house actually has the activate instead of discard.
Right.
Which is really interesting, because otherwise they kind of both fit, and this is what makes the fate location so fun to put together for customs, is that both of them, to an extent, have that same sort of utilitarian, something's not really going my way, so let's fix it, kind of feel to them.
Right.
Like, for example, you very rarely ever see gain two and fate in the same place.
No, I mean, the only person that's got it is Ursa. Well, no, Captain Hook has it, too.
Captain Hook has it because Hangman's Tree is locked, and that's a really good location otherwise.
And we'll get to locked locations.
Yeah, locked locations are special.
Yeah.
But by and large, gain two and fate don't really happen next to each other, because that's just a really powerful place to go.
Yeah. It's kind of what I've always told players about. You know, people probably see me on Discord talk a lot about Grow Giant recently. And my whole my whole thing, why I'm not super big fan of Grow Giant like that is because if you notice like any other cards that allow you to maybe gain extra power or gain a lot of extra utility, like from the get go, you are, if you want to be able to move towards your goal really fast, you're not gaining a lot of money. You're not or you have to have all the setup ready to go before you go do that. So like with the Gorge, for example, with Scar, you have to already, you know, be able to play a card that allows you to do some extra shenanigans to like vanquish or be able to kill a high strength hero and then fate, but you have to have the resources to do it. There really isn't, for the exception, I would say really of two characters, the true utility location with that character has a lot of like power gain and stuff like that. It just doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, with the last location in the realms, this is kind of the interesting one, where usually in most cases, there are some rare circumstances. The other location usually has two power, but then the actions on it are kind of a mix between a lot of different hodgepodge of stuff.
Yeah. This kind of goes down to something I mentioned before about wanting to keep a play action at each location. There's a specific ratio of actions, like everyone has two fates, pretty much everyone has two discards. If you're going to have activate as a main part of your synergy, there's definitely going to be two of those. If you're moving stuff around a lot, there's going to be two moves. And this one game two location is usually the one that holds all of the leftovers, basically.
Right. Which is, I've always found really interesting, just because, like, so many different characters have so many different hodgepodge of stuff. Like we were talking about, you know, the day of this, it's the day after I did the Radican breakdown on stream. And I was looking at Big Ben and I'm like, wow, Big Ben is just like, it's like they took the rest of the actions that they needed for Radigan that you probably should have and put them in a pot and just throw them at the location.
Exactly. There's always going to be one location like that for everybody, because for the most part, when you're designing how you want the character to run, you can get all of the stuff. Like, but once you have the fate and the discard and the play and the power spots all spread out correctly, there's really only one location's worth of stuff left that you need to find space for.
Right.
And so that's just the filler location.
Now, it is kind of interesting, because we have two characters that actually kind of throw this location on its head, and it's Scar and Mother Gothel. And the reason, and it's funny, because they actually have all the same actions at that location, then again, a little differently placed, but those are character-specific stuff. But those characters have two play card actions, which is not normal.
Yeah, having two locations with play card twice is pretty good.
Yeah.
Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I found that as a great utility with Scar. So
beautifully, because it and with Scar, it has to do with once a card has been put onto his board, unless it's a stampede, really, it's not going to be doing a whole lot. You just kind of put it where you want it to be and go. To balance for that, they gave him an extra location with two play actions because he really gets his juice from playing those cards.
Right. He doesn't have a lot of cards that have one trick pony kind of uses, especially with the allies.
His thing is like he doesn't have a reason to be moving them around that much necessarily.
Right.
And he has plenty of ways to move them around anyway. So you're not going to do anything else with that spot.
No, exactly. It's the same deal with Mother Gothel too, where once her cards are kind of out, they're just kind of out. You can move them around probably a lot more, like, they have a lot more effectiveness moving around than, like, maybe Scar. But even then, like, she has a lot of cards that they need to be played to do anything. And if they're not played, then they're just kind of sitting there.
Yeah, Gothel's realm in general is a really fun one to kind of talk about, because a lot of the usual design paradigms they go with kind of get thrown out the window when it comes to Gothel's realm.
Yes.
And that mostly has to do with Rapunzel being always there.
Yeah, absolutely.
The reason both the Snuggly Duckling and the Forest have just the single play action on top mostly boils down to that's about the least impactful thing that Rapunzel could be covering.
Right.
If that makes sense. And yeah. It doesn't make sense for the forest not to have another play action, so you can at least do something while Rapunzel is there. So thus, having the two locations was two plays.
No, it makes perfect sense. Especially, like, you know, we didn't get super detailed about Gothel, but, like, Rapunzel moves from left to right. Those two are going to be the first two that get hit by Rapunzel, so it makes perfect sense to make sure that those two spaces are kind of opened up.
No, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It guarantees that regardless of where Rapunzel is, you have a location that you can play two cards from.
Yeah. Kind of speaking on that, though, the next part about the engine with the realm I want to talk about with the locations, string of words right there, is kind of the placement of the actions. So obviously, if for whatever reason you do not know anything about Villainous, but let me try to say it for you. When a hero is played to a location, it blocks the top actions, the top portion actions of the character. So that means that when a player would move to that location, they are limited on their action economy. So, and usually what happens is, like, there's usually four actions at a location. There are circumstances where that's not the case. But as soon as the hero gets played, they're knocking out two, meaning that player has a lot less options at that location, making it a lot less desirable to go to. And especially if it's an action that they need to do, which for some characters, that's actually something they need to get. They need to defeat that hero. So I kind of mentioned this already, that like the three power, there's all for each character always has a location that's at least got three power and a play card at the bottom. That is never going to get blocked up. You always have that location to gain money and play something. The other locations, though, it's kind of a mixed bag. And I honestly, and we don't have to go into super deep conversation on this, but I think it really just kind of depends on the character. It really does. It
kind of does. But the pattern you really start noticing is that you have the game three and the play action in one place. You'll always have one fade action, one discard, and usually one move action that are always going to be available for you. Depending on what your setup is and how heavily you rely on activates, one of your activates may be guaranteed, but that's the one that's not always around. Right. Looking especially, again, at Cruella, where both of her really super important activates can get covered in a situation where she can't really do much about it.
Especially also with Cruella, it's the move action, too. Both of her move actions get covered as well. Yeah,
they can be. And then she really gets put in a bit of a tight spot because she can't really do anything at that point.
Nope.
That's why whatever it takes is it exists.
Yeah, no. And Grant, and that's you know, that's part of the deck composition of like, yeah, we know that's a thing. So we're going to put something in there to help counter that.
Yeah.
I do think, what is it? And like, whenever I think about this, I always bring up Hades, because I think Hades is probably the best example of how they were trying to balance a character. And I think to the most part, they did a good job with Hades kind of being this representation of it. But like, Hades needs to move stuff. So he has one move action at the bottom, and then he has one at the top. And it's kind of a consistent thing where most of the characters, they have like that core actions that they need for the player to do to really advance their goal. At one location at the bottom, or, you know, maybe a mixture between two, but then some other ones, they have them at the top to really kind of stop.
It incentivizes the opponent to fake you.
Right.
Because if they don't, and you have access to that action, you can just plow right past them.
Right. I've definitely played in my early days when I was playing Hades, when people weren't understanding to play a hero at Mount Olympus. There was some fun stuff you can do. But that's with any character though. One thing to note too, Vanquish is always at the bottom.
Yep. And then with the exception of Ursula and
Queen, she just doesn't have
Evil Queen, yeah. They don't have them.
They just don't
Everyone's
have
gonna have one somewhere.
Yeah. Always have that. Cause obviously if you didn't have the Vanquish action there,
you
know,
you
wouldn't be able to
defeat
stuff. Yeah, just be impossible. Then it's not a fun time. But yeah, it's I generally with each of the characters, like those locations, really it depends on like, and this is like when playtesting a bunch with the character probably comes into play, where like you know, why was the decision to put the fate action at the bottom here compared to here? And like I said, that one, and obviously you pointed this out with like the exception of like Queen of Hearts, like every single character for the most part has that one power, discard, play card, fate. But each of the characters has those in different positions. So it's, and I can't really speak for every single character why that's set up the way it is for all of them, but it's, there's definitely like when you play a character a lot, like I understand with Scar why for him he's got the play, like the gain one and the discard at the bottom, because he already has a play card at the top, or he's already got two places where he can basically play two cards twice, so you can cover that one up and remove the other play card, and then fate, you know, it just makes sense.
It, that part, it really is, does kind of boil down to playtesting, but also it's kind of thematic in a way.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Because like with Scar, the Gorge is the Vanquish Shack location, makes perfect sense.
Exactly.
The Gorge being his super stampede abusing location, makes sense.
Perfect sense.
Obviously.
Right.
Pride Rock being the other game 2 location. Because that's another that's the place in the movie that he spends most of his time, if you want to think of it that way.
Yeah,
he would have the most influence there, thus the two power over one anywhere else.
Yeah. The location's definitely like something to keep in mind is like, and I think Ditto, you pointed this out, where it's like there is always the villain's lair. And then also, yeah, like the hero's
first
domain.
Location that you start in will always be whatever location is really kind of your place.
Right.
This is your home, basically. And
yeah. And then, like, the tools that you get at that location are relative to,
are the
like,
best ones.
What,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's usually, like, the gain to hodgepodge location, but it's the best, like, it's a good place for it.
Right.
Because there's a lot of tools there that you can use to speed things along without falling behind a whole lot.
Right.
Especially with Queen of Hearts, where that courtyard is gain to play, discard, and move.
Yeah, which is, that's like the pure epitome
everything
of
everything she wants. Yeah, it's like, if you're having problems with anything, just go over there.
Right.
That'll fix you up.
No. Yeah. Yeah, always make sure when you look at the, like, and also, like, if you're not customizing, like, just, like, an appreciation towards the theme, like, look at those locations and see what the actions that they give, because there are definitely, like, if you look at even Dr. Facilier, like, the Voodoo Emporium having the fate, the play card, and the Vanquish, it all just makes sense. Like,
beautiful. Yeah.
It's very thematic. It even, like, little things, like, when you look at, going back to Facilier, like, the parade location has the move action. Well, it makes perfect sense, because guess what parades do? They move.
Yep.
So, it makes a lot of
little
sense.
Little jokes like that.
Yeah, like, it's, and that stuff goes a long way too from, like, you know, I talk about with this game, with me personally, how it just feels good to play it. Those types of things go a long way, especially if you're really drilling in theme. You know, don't just make the location have the action economy because maybe that's the best balance thing. Sometimes the doing the thematics part also is going to help with that too.
We've hit before on how big a part thematics play in this game and how this game chooses to run itself, to the point where I'd say thematics itself could be considered part of the engine of the game.
Oh yeah,
just
for
because
sure.
Of how many different decisions go into, okay, how do we make this feel like the character?
Absolutely. We'll get to that. The last thing I want to talk about with the realm before we kind of jump off of the realm is the lock location.
Yeah, locks are fun.
Let me say this. So in the base game has probably the, like, literally has the most locked location characters. There's three of them. And thematically, all three of those characters having that location locked makes a lot of sense. It does. And even with Evil Queen having her locked location makes a lot of sense. However, there's definitely something that the designers understood while going forward with the characters, that locked locations, while they're really cool thematically, you got to make sure that you balance the character correctly if you're going to do that.
One thing you notice, especially with Hook in this case, is that the Hangman's Tree is just a beautiful, beautiful location.
Oh, There's so many stupid busted.
It's so, like, you've got the game too. Like, it's basically the hodgepodge location for him. But it's got the move hero, which obviously he needs to win, but at the same time with Ingenious Device can end up as just kind of a really, really, really busted spot.
Right.
The thing about lock locations is you have to balance the majority of the game with the assumption that you don't have access to it.
Right.
So all of a sudden, all of these core discard, move, activate, gain, like power gain locations, you have to condense all down to three instead of four, which limits your options as far as like realm design by a surprising amount. To the point where usually, if like that character's top fate action is going to be locked.
Yeah. Which
in a lot of instances, which makes sense. Stops you from necessarily being able to do the fate every turn thing while it's not unlocked. Gives you some incentive to unlock it a little bit sooner if you have to. While not completely breaking it.
It's rough because like thematically these characters really need that locked location, but like I've always kind of, and we've learned this with the later designs, like, I think Cruella really nails it on the head where, like, you know, like, she has a location, no locations that are locked, but she has a location that's got five actions on it. And there's very clear design things that I think they could have done with these locked characters, particularly Ursula, I think, is the one that probably needed a little bit more time to cook with that locked mechanism that she has.
It's funny, because thematically, what they have her doing actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. It's just more the fact that, like, you know, and we've back at episode 4 of the podcast when we were talking about this, like, I think
back
the biggest
in the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. I think the biggest thing that they did with Ursula, and just the, and this is overall just with Ursula's design, is that they did not put the activate action at the bottom at the lair. So literally, as soon as you start loading up on those cards that you'd use to activate and gain the activate bonuses, a player is going to block that thing. And then all of a sudden, you have a really important piece of your tool set that just kind of got destroyed. And Ursula isn't really a character that can vanquish in a turn easily. She can't.
It's really hard.
Yeah, and like, and since you're already limited with only three locations, it becomes even more difficult. I think they tried to balance that out with Evil Queen a little bit by giving her a little bit more action economy with just even her cards. Like they, like all of her ingredients have all these unique little bonus effects on them that kind of act as their own little actions.
And on top of that, she's also got, you know, all those copies of Alphixia that are like, well, you're getting hero flooded, but we'll throw you a bone here.
Right, exactly.
Because otherwise, there's just no way.
Right. And then, you know, we can talk about how incredibly powerful Evil Queen is, but obviously, because of that extra action economy that she can do, she's also one of the most powerful characters overall in the game in a 1v1 environment, you know?
Trying to get the action economy thing right is probably the most interesting. And that's why I kind of like to talk to the game a little more as resource management, not necessarily card management.
Now,
because action management is a big part of the game too. And if you're a character who can really abuse your actions, all of a sudden you've become a really serious threat.
No, I agree. Because like, you know, like Scar, like not to keep throwing out Scar, but obviously you all know that I love Scar and I play the living hell out of him. But like part of that too is like, all right, am I going to play a hyena at this location so I can abuse the action there would stick with me? You know, it's like those types of things that you have to think about when using your actions.
And,
or
and
like even
another
with
thing that you'll bring it back to Evil Queen for a second, something I just thought about. Evil Queen is the only character with a lock location where the game two, like the game two action isn't locked.
No.
That should tell you something about Evil Queen.
Oh yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Like it, They thought about that when designing the character. Like, they were like, okay.
Without a doubt. Because Evil Queen, I think, out of all of the locked characters, bar Ursula, because she can never unlock anything, really.
Right.
Is the one where you're going to be spending the most amount of time with that location locked. Because Hook and Jafar, you'll be through the deck, and you'll definitely get it unlocked eventually. But I think Evil Queen is the one that really stays with that lock the longest, on average.
Right.
And as a result, they said, okay, well, maybe we can make this location a bit less powerful. And it makes thematic sense, too, because it's not like the Evil Queen really does that much at the cottage other than poison Snow White. Big surprise.
Yeah. That also goes back to the thematics where, like, a lot of the locations that the characters don't really interact with, the villains specifically don't interact with very much, those usually are the locations that they don't do a lot.
Yeah. The one exception to that, I think, is Jafar and the Oasis.
Yeah, that's the only one.
The Oasis kind of being his big power play location, where the Streets of Agrabah, which is kind of his throwaway one.
Yeah.
He never really went out among the commoners.
No. He does want to dig for them cards, though.
Oh, he absolutely does. No doubt about that. That's one of the reasons I despise him.
You and your luck.
Exactly.
Beautiful, beautiful luck.
There's a reason I don't like item digging characters.
No, I know that. I know that from you. But yeah, I would, and not to try to go into speculation talk, but sometimes we have to kind of bring it up a little bit. And I think this is apparent. But like with some of the characters that we think might come, like I'm specifically calling out Gaston, where it's like, all right, do you really have Gaston willingly go to Beast Castle? Like, that's also, like, even from a design perspective, it's like, okay, there are certain characters, like, you should still be using the lock token with.
Yeah.
But how you give them that
and
is, yeah.
They've definitely weaned themselves off of the lock token, I think, because in part they realize that having more available options is just more fun.
Absolutely.
But thematically, I cannot see a Gaston where the castle doesn't at least start locked.
No. Yeah.
Because it goes to a thematic thing where he's having to actively go out of his way to figure out where this castle is. Like, he doesn't know how to get there until he has the mirror.
Exactly.
So it makes sense. With Hook and the map, makes sense. I did Frollo and gave him a lock location, even though I'm not the biggest fan of it. Why? Because how is Frollo going to find the Court of Miracles if Quasimodo doesn't lead him there?
Exactly.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing is, you have to, and the thing, I think they tried to do this with Evil Queen, and it was kind of clear after that they were kind of like, yeah, we don't want to do this right now. But
Evil Queen's thematics behind it are a little bit different, because she's not going out of her way to find this cottage. She already knows where the cottage is. The reason it's locked is because she doesn't want to go there as the queen. She wants to go as the hag, thus having to gather all the ingredients first, which I think
is then she unlocks it. Yeah,
yeah, and then she can go freely go over there and do whatever shenanigans she wants.
Exactly. To go wander around. I'm looking for Snow White, everybody. Yeah, no. I gotta do my squawk voice. But no, you're absolutely right though. Like you gotta think of it that way too, where like if the character isn't directly gonna be going to that location until they're primed and prepped and ready to go, that's also something to keep in mind with the locked location. But I think really with these locked location characters, and I'm curious if we get, you know, when we get the next slew of Disney characters, once we get Gaston, there will be a lock token. Like, I wonder what they've learned, and I want to see it implemented so we can kind of use
obviously
that.
Obviously, with Evil Queen, one of the things they've learned is that locking the game to at the start of the game is not always a good thing.
Right.
Especially. And so I'll just go ahead and throw this out there. Even with that game 2 unlocked as the Evil Queen, I've still found myself power starved a few times.
Oh yeah, for sure.
With her. So yeah. Like, don't get it in your mind that just because the 2 power is unlocked doesn't, like, that guarantees that you're never going to have power issues.
I mean, Hades has that too. If you play a hero. If you play a hero to that location.
Hero there, and all of a sudden you've got dire problems.
Yeah, exactly. So that's an interesting point too, to bring up with Evil Queen, is that like they knew that Hero moving around is going to be, or like heroes would be detrimentally hit her action economy, but they don't want that to be an abusive tool. So what did they do? Put the move Hero action at the top of that location. So if you do move it to that location, you can't use it again, unless you obviously use Alfixia and stuff like that.
Now, another thing that is kind of interesting to note, that, again, besides Ursula, because Ursula breaks every rule of this game.
Absolutely.
Is that if you have a lock token, more than likely you're going to have a hero that will be play itself there to that location at some point in the game. For Hook, it's Peter Pan. For Jafar, it's the genie. For Evil Queen, it's Snow White.
Yeah.
Even when you get into Frollo. With Frollo, it's Quasimodo. Quasimodo will end up at the Court of Miracles at some point. It's guaranteed.
Exactly. I mean, same deal with Gaston. You know Beast exactly. is going to be at the castle.
That unlocked. You know he's going to be waiting for you.
Yeah.
But exactly. You have to take that into consideration when you're building the realm for that, too. Because, yeah, this location's locked, so you don't have access to any of it. But even once it is opened, there's going to be a hero there.
More than likely.
So that's worth keeping in mind, too. Yeah. To not make it a complete dead draw.
Yeah. Well, it's because Jafar is weird because by default, you can't play the hero there, but you have to play the lamp there. And then Genie will get played.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
he's kind of the special one where if you get the pendant early enough, you can actually abuse that location pretty easily.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Hook doesn't necessarily have that much leeway just because Pan plays himself where the Genie can be discarded.
Exactly.
And even, I mean, I mentioned before about how Evil Queen's never going to have the cottage unlocked that early, so who cares?
Right.
Ursula, who cares?
Yeah, no, it's
nothing about her makes sense.
I will say this up front. I've been having more fun playing Ursula recently in some stuff that I've been doing, but I would strongly recommend...
The reason for that is that, and this is one thing where, yeah, she was probably the last one designed and didn't go through enough playtesting. But out of the core six, she is definitely the one that most abuses the base engine.
Oh, for sure.
Because you don't vanquish normally. You don't unlock anything. You only have a couple allies, so you can't really trigger conditions all that often.
Yeah, she's a special case. I would strongly not recommend to make a character like Ursula unless you really think you know what you're doing. I think it's funny. We keep bringing up Evil Queen like she's like this godsend to this game or something like that in terms of design. And though she kind of is. Ursula has this issue where she has this.
I think that Evil Queen breaks the engine in all of the right ways where Ursula messed it up.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Because like with Ursula, vanquishing stuff is like horrible. But with Evil Queen, yeah, it's thematic.
It's really easy.
It's easy to do, you know, it like you have many ways to do it, you know, and you, most of the time you'll be able to do it. No problem. You know,
and I think is why people were so excited about Evil Queen when she showed up and was this good, because in the back of their minds, you realize, hey, she's trying to do all the same stuff that Ursula did, but it doesn't suck to play.
Yeah, seriously. Because that's the thing is, like, you know, like, when you get those, like, contract kills with Ursula, it does feel pretty good to do it. It just takes way too much time and action to come.
Yeah, the reason it's so satisfying to pull off is because it's hard.
Right. Absolutely. It's difficult. But I digress. I can sit here and talk about Ursula, Evil Queen shenanigans all day. But, I mean, honestly, though, they are really two good examples of pointing out the good and the good and the flaws of some of the balancing of the characters in ways, even with the realms specifically, you know, with like the action economy and everything.
Now,
let's get to the decks. I want to talk about decks because decks are fun, both fate decks and villain decks, but we'll start with villain decks. Something I've noticed that's kind of interesting with this game. Is that so? The decks themselves are kind of treated them like trading card game decks. Like, it's a pre-built deck that has some synergy built around it. Now, most trading card games have some type of, like, limit on the card count for reasons for balancing. But I think what this game does and really well is that they know what tools really need to exist within these characters. So they make sure you have lots of tools to work with that character.
And this part is where it starts getting really, really fun to think about, because a lot of the, like, collectible card games don't, like, they have pre-built decks, but most of the time they're designed so that you can collect the cards and build your own style of game.
Right.
Villainous obviously doesn't have that, but instead they give you this wide array of different things you can do as the character. I'll pick on Jafar here, because why not? He's got plenty of allies with the guards and Razul, and plenty of swords to give them to buff them up so that they can take out heroes themselves. If you don't like that strategy, you've got Hypnotize. You can just pay to take the heroes out directly. If you don't like that strategy, you've got Snake Am I to just kill them outright. So you've got all these different ways to deal with heroes, but they all cater to a different playstyle. And Jafar, I think, actually is the one that epitomizes that the most.
For an obvious reason.
Pete does as well, to an extent, just based on the RNG of the goals.
That's true.
Because we were kind of talking before about how Noxili is a fake card that really negatively affects a lot of goals. But by contrast, you've got Sneaky Pete, which can set up a lot of your goals for you.
Right. It's cool because, and, like, you know, going off of Sneaky Pete, like, you could technically win a game with Pete and never play that card.
If you wanted to, yeah, you could. Rely exclusively on,
you know,
just hard draws and hope for the best.
Right. And that's kind of what I find, you know, really fun about this game is that, and also, you know, side tangent, but it's relatable. You know, I talk about Killer Instinct a lot on the podcast, and some of you guys are like, come on, Killer Instinct, it's a video game and a fighting game. We're Smash Brothers. What Killer Instinct does really well is that each of the characters plays radically differently to the other one. But even within that character, you as a player can identify your own play style and use those different attacks in your own way that is different from player B. And Villainous, the way the decks are constructed, they give you enough tools to operate those different play styles in the way that you want to. Like, you made a really good point with Jafar, where he has three different ways to vanquish stuff. And also tools to help with the vanquishing. Because you didn't even bring up... Now, it's not necessarily directly a vanquishing.
Yeah, that doesn't even count the hourglass.
Or the hourglass. He's got all these tools to vanquish heroes in different ways. And you can... And granted, part of the strategy game aspect of it is like, all right, you know, playstyle-wise, I like playing these cards. But I have to think about right now in the situation that I'm in, if I play this particular card this way, is that more effective? Action effective, power effective, you know, all that stuff.
Which, again, is kind of something Jafar has that no one else really does. A lot of those characters have their variants come in other places. With Hades, you could kind of take or leave whether you want to be play one Titan, move them across, play the next one, go across one at a time, or if you want to just pile all the Titans on at once and then rush them all over slowly.
Right. That's one of the things that I've told, that I've mentioned this before, funny enough, bring it back, Ursula. You gotta, from design as well as playing the characters, there has to be multiple ways to get to the win condition. There can't be one set way of doing one particular thing. Now, some of you might argue, well, with Jafar, you have to make sure you play the Scarab Pendant before the Magic Lamp, and yeah, you're right. But, you know, even then, you can, like, if you don't get the Magic Lamp right away, what do you do? If you don't get the Scarab Pendant and you have the lamp, do you play Gazeem? discard the lamp, wait till you're ready to get the lamp back and do stuff with that. The journey to winning the game is going to be different every time, and the design of each villain shows that. You know, like they understand that, like, there should not be one direct way to accomplish the goal. Now, obviously, over time in the competitive side, you're going to develop more effective ways of accomplishing goals, no doubt.
Like, but, even somebody that has gratefully managed to avoid being brought up so far, Prince John.
Oh.
Even him, when you think about him, you can play like I did on stream that one time, where it's just super hyper-aggressive, kill every hero, double bow and arrow with the golden arrow.
Jesus God, that was a combo.
To just rake in cash. You could play completely pacifistic, take out Little John when he shows up every now and again, and otherwise just pile up heroes and beautiful lovely taxes. They both work.
Yeah, and that's not even saying the fact that you can just kind of like, you know, just play nothing but like taxes and never gain action or money from
you
your
can
actual locations.
Dig and bait and set up for double greed plays.
Exactly.
If you want
which is awesome. And I think that goes into the fact that like a lot of the different characters have multiple copies of cards, and the only copies of cards that are unique are ones that you like that make sense thematically. Like, you know, obviously, you know, there's not going to be three copies of Iago in the deck, you know, or like three copies of Snake Staff. There's only one copy of Snake Staff because Jafar has one Snake Staff and one Guilford Godfrey, you know, like it's those types of things that like those cards then stand out more because they're kind of like your power play cards. Because like as someone who used to play a lot of Hearthstone, and for those of you who did play Hearthstone, like you all know that like with the I think it's the legendary cards, they specifically say that like with the legendary cards, you can only have one copy of that card in your deck. Now you can have tons of them in your deck, but only one copy. And it makes sense because those unique characters are supposed to be powerful, you know, and you want to make them stand out when they do.
They are, yeah. They're going to be unique combinations of things that can be done that are a little too much to have three or four copies of just hanging around.
No, for sure. I mean, like, I've been playing a lot against a hook. And, you know, like Starkey and Smee, powerful cards. Smee is a cheaper pirate brute if he's at the Jolly Roger. And Starkey is directly like, hey, I'm going to move heroes around for you without having to use the move hero action. You know, really powerful, really unique too.
That's where the fun distinction between actual named characters and just generic minions comes into play. If you'll notice, Maleficent doesn't really have any sort of unique characters to herself besides maybe the Raven.
Right.
The rest of her allies are just an army of mooks, basically.
Yeah, and those versus, I mean, and it's funny too, because it's like a Rhino Guards and the is it the Savage Goon that's the big beefy one?
It is.
You'll notice that they don't have any special effects.
Yeah, they don't have anything special about them. They're just cost, strength, go.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing too special.
Versus somebody like Ursula, who's only got Flotsam and Jetsam, who are both really named, really important to her. You've got Hades, where every single one of his allies is unique. And they each have this one little thing that's like, oh, maybe I could do this way.
Exactly. Which I think it makes it really fun. And I've seen some custom stuff where people are like, you only have like, they'll have multiple copies of a card and they'll say like, you only have one of these in play. Strongly recommend don't do that.
If you feel that necessary, you probably only need one copy in the deck anyway.
Right.
Because only 30 cards there, the odds that you find it are pretty high.
Exactly.
Unless you're me and playing Hades, because then that chariot just doesn't exist.
I need to rub some of my luck off on you. That's what I need to do. That way you feel a little better about yourself when you're playing that character. But and in terms of like the overall like engine based stuff with the deck and like some of the main cards, like the amount of that you have a particular like card types, like effects and items and allies and et cetera, is really dependent on the villain and what their goal is. You know, we bring up, I keep bringing up Evil Queen and Ursula, but like, you'll notice that they don't really have a lot of allies is because they don't vanquish normally. So there's no reason to try to focus on having a bunch of allies that do, you know, no vanquishing, you know?
Yeah, and they've each got 5 or 6 copies of the card that lets them kill things, which is about a fifth of the deck, which makes sense.
Exactly. It makes perfect sense. Now, granted, like, some characters that, you know, and Jafar is actually a good example of this where, you know, and I was talking about this with Radigan, where Jafar has allies, but he doesn't have a ton. And not all of them are super, like, strength-heavy vanquish stuff. Because even, like, Iago, I would say probably debatably one of his best allies, is a one-strength ally. And his goal is, I'm going to activate you and move your lamp around. That's what he's meant to do.
Yeah. Not every ally is going to be used for a quick kill.
Yeah.
For sure.
And that's something I want to bring up that I think is really important with developing decks and like deck creation is that a lot of this game is defeating the fate cards that come your way as much as you trying to accomplish your goal. And you need to make sure that there are some defense tools in the deck if you're not going to have a ton of allies to go up against that. So like with Jafar, for example, he's got Hypnotize and a Snake Amai. So he has ways to defeat heroes when they get played to those locations with that card, which is super helpful. And like even with Hypnotize, where you can hypnotize heroes and make them your allies. So you can change up the fact that you don't have a lot of allies in your deck.
Yeah. I think that's why Hypnotize works so well with Jafar, is because he has so few allies he can really spare to vanquish with, he can just make his own instead.
Exactly. Whatever. It's like thematically makes sense.
Right.
And like even with the point out Radigan from earlier, like it doesn't even necessarily need to be vanquishing. You can use it to move them to a location that doesn't have anything at the top. So even with Prince John, with Imprison and with Radigan, it's capture. Exactly.
Just putting them somewhere where they're not in the way.
Exactly. You don't have to have everything be vanquished fodder, you know, stuff like that.
Part of the later stages of me developing Oogie, one of the big things, because he doesn't vanquish traditionally, is he has to have ways to get rid of heroes. So what I went with is shuffle them back into the fate deck.
Which still works.
Put them out of the way.
they're not in the way. They weren't technically vanquished, and granted, maybe they might come back, but...
They'll be back eventually, but they're not my problem right now.
They're no longer an issue. So that's important. And that's like, I remember when I first got introduced to this game and people were trying to from the original Discord and like members of that was like, they were saying like, this game is a puzzle and it's like a dynamic puzzle that you're trying to solve because in theory, yeah, you're trying to accomplish your goal, but really the opponent is still dealing twist of fate at you that you have to deal with along the way. And part of the deck design can't be just strictly around just trying to achieve your goal.
Yeah, it also has got to be some mitigation in there.
That's half of it.
And another big part of it that kind of goes back to the card managing aspect is your ability to cycle through your cards, your ability to get to what you need more quickly.
Yes.
There's a reason that so many characters in this game have some version of scrying.
Right. And it's in different ways, but they're all always targeted towards things that you need. So
they target the things that you know you're going to need. For Ursa, you know you're going to need contracts eventually. So her big mill card involves finding you a contract. May not be the one you want, but it'll be something.
Yeah. And it's funny, too, with Divination, it's kind of also a double thing where with Ursula, you know, you want to discard one of the items you need.
You want them to be gone. Who cares? Just go fish it back. Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You got opportunists. Grab it back.
Hook kind of turns that situation on his head because he grinds through his fate deck instead.
No, exactly. He does something very different where he's like, I'm trying to find Peter Pan.
Not only is he trying to find Peter Pan, but he's burning his way past everything else to get to him.
Which is
the beauty part.
Which is awesome. It's so great. Everyone's always got those in, like, not every character's got, like, the form of scrying, And I noticed with some of the characters, those cards are more expensive. So, like, to point out Evil Queen, she's got Black Magic, where she can just straight up fish out an ingredient or an item from her
Black Magic is the best card in the game.
Oh, like, yeah, for sure.
You cannot convince me otherwise. It's not overly expensive. Two is not that bad, unless you're just really having a bad power game. To go get literally pretty much half the deck.
Yeah,
just go find whatever you want.
Yeah, anything you want.
It's yours. Yeah. And it might not even be one of the ingredients of the mirror. It may be, oh, I'm not drawing my tones. Let's go find one of those so I can start just really grinding through things.
Right.
Like, having a big search card, like, there's a reason in Magic the Gathering all of those really good search cards are banned.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny, because I played a lot of the Dragon Ball TCG, and there's not really that many search cards. There really isn't, which is funny.
Pretty good.
Yeah. There's a few, but not a whole lot. But yeah, no. And the funny thing too that you got to think about with this is that a lot of those cards revolve around one of the things that you need. So let's bring up Evil Queen again, Black Magic, or even Magic Tomes. You're discarding stuff that way. Doesn't get you Take a Bite. It does not. It does not give you that card.
It Same doesn't directly give it to you.
Yeah.
But you can always choose to keep it.
Exactly.
Or an ingredient. Or the mirror. Or just kind of whatever.
Yeah. With Hook, yeah, you have the ability to manipulate your Fate deck, but you having to try to find the map and cycle that out is on your own action economy fruition.
Right.
You don't have any direct control over that besides just drawing stuff.
You know who does have direct control over that, though? Scar.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Scar is a very unique case of being able to grind through both decks on his own terms.
Which is fantastic.
Which is kind of nice.
Now, I
borrowed that for Frollo.
Yeah. The thing with Scar, though, and I think it's really thematic, is the fact that, like, when you play Be Prepared, you have to you discard, and then you look through your entire discard pile. And sometimes what might happen is that, like, oh, I'm playing Be Prepared, and I'm literally using this to grab back this Hyena and this Stampede. And then you play Be Prepared, and you discard three Long Live the Kings. And then you're like, oh, no.
Whoops.
Yeah, like, oh, crap. You
better
know?
Make this thing work.
Yeah. Or even with the Long Live the King itself, where you're like, okay, I'm going to play Long Live the King, and I might risk, you know, getting closer to a Kuun Matata or the monkey. Or you might be like, oh no, I drew Mufasa, Simba, you know, another hero that you might want to get rid of. And you're like, I now have to whisper that hero back out and plan that way. You know, it's like, there's always some kind of risk reward with it. Cause like, even with scrying, like, granted, you can play Snake Staff and get the hypnotized card back, but
yeah, scrying is a fun one because it actually searches for two, like, for one of two card types.
Right.
Just as a little strategy tidbit for you guys, I usually pick the opposite of the one I actually want. That way the one I want gets discarded and I can just go fish it back later.
That's
right. If you're trying to get to the Scarab Pendant, use scrying and pick ally. That way when the pendant, or really the lamp for that matter, get discarded, Gazeem can just pull it back.
That's right. Because and the nice thing about Jafar's deck is that they actually make that something you can do, because you can play Necessary Sacrifice.
Exactly. You can just throw it away.
Yeah, exactly. There's that's like some common themes that we've seen. And
oh yeah.
Now go ahead.
That's the really big common ones. There's a lot of characters that also have like the zero cost gain power.
Oh,
effects.
Yeah.
You know, your very merry on birthdays, your fake funerals, your I live for furs, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's pretty standard. And it's a pretty good card for those gain one play fate locations. Just to give it a little bit of a boost if you don't really have anything else to do.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have to be able to enable them, which is why they're all so weirdly situational.
Yeah, and they cost nothing.
Yeah, and they all cost nothing, so you're not spending... The only difference in that regard is play a game.
True.
Which costs two, yes, but odds are you'll probably at least gain one power out of it.
Yeah, or two, and just go neutral.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, those zero-cost cards are usually, like, power gain tools with the characters in some shape or form. It's like, the way I kind of describe it is that the zero-cost ones have some sort of requirement attached to them that is a variable that
or
you can
either get
or a little off of it, which is nice.
Or they're just Bartholomew.
Oh, yeah, or they're Bartholomew. But even Bartholomew, too, like, he's kind of in a weird situation, a power card, because if you want to play Felicia,
later. Yeah,
exactly. You save yourself money, because the thing I was talking about on the Radigan thing last night that I did was, like, even if you do it with the Ruffians or Fidget, you're still technically spending more money to play that ally out. Like, Felicia, in still theory, still costed 5 or 4 power to play.
Right.
So that's, like, the things you have to think about when you want to be able to do those types of things. But even with Radigan, like, you have gain 2 power, draw 2 cards, you know?
Yeah.
So it exists. Everyone's got, like, that zero cost card that has some type of, like, needed requirement on it before you can't do anything with it.
Which is important, because if every card costs 2, then nobody could ever play anything.
Right.
Other than that, I think that's most of the bases covered.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the last thing I guess we'll talk about is kind of the Fate deck.
There's less, in general, less. I don't want to say less consistency to the Fate deck compared to the villains, but it's a lot more theme dependent. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with the Fate deck is that, like, the Fate deck, I would say, is probably one of the most thematic parts of the villain in general, because the heroes themselves are just such standouts.
It can be the most thematic part. It can also be really underwhelming if you're not careful.
That's true.
I'm not super into Gothel's Fate deck a whole lot.
Yeah, Gothel's Fate deck is kind of meh. It's
pretty just standard stuff at that point.
Right.
You've got the, oh, you discard a card. Oh, you lose a power. Oh, you get sent back. Like, whatever.
Right. The
The one big, like, feature of the Fate deck that is kind of normal is the hero that's like, if this card's revealed, you can play both Fate cards.
Yeah, that's a consistent.
It's kind of the freebie hero. But that's really the only super consistent.
Yeah, it's not in every deck, but, like, that, how, where that character lies and, like, how much power they cost and all that stuff is very consistent. One of the things with the Fate deck, I will point out, is one of the cool things I actually think is a usability, like, accessibility feature of this game that I think is really clever, is that if you know the movie, the main hero, or heroes, quote-unquote, are usually the most powerful cards.
Definitely. And they're the most sort of disruptive to the game.
Absolutely.
For the most part. They have a tendency to be a little situational sometimes. For example, Robin Hood is actually a surprisingly situational card.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, then you've got the ones like Alice and Ariel and even kind of Rapunzel to an extent that are just like, all right, this is an issue.
Yeah. And then, like, the lower, like, the lesser popular characters that they include usually don't do as much. Although there's a few scenarios where, like, that, like, they're more the minor characters are more towards, like, all right, this particular card we're going to try to cancel out. While the bigger heroes are more like a general, like, overarching. Yeah, we're going to halt the game in a more overarching way.
And don't forget either that every hero blocks actions.
Oh, for sure.
So even if you have, like, draw a hero that doesn't do anything now, block actions.
Exactly.
Like, you can slow people down that way.
No, absolutely. One thing I will note and this is obviously goes into balancing and stuff like that, is that hero strength is going to be all over the board and it's going to be different from hero to hero or from villain to villain. And it's based off of like win conditions and stuff like that. Basil is stronger than Simba, which makes perfect sense.
Well, Basil, not only is he a lot stronger, but he's a lot more disruptive than Simba.
Yeah.
Simba definitely has, like, gives Scar problems, but he can be overcome. Basil is just a problem from start to finish.
Yeah.
He's hard to kill. He disrupts your everything. Even when your goal switches to killing him, he's still hard to kill. Like...
Yeah, no, he, no, and, like, and even, like, going without that, like, Kuzco. Like, Kuzco is stronger, Peter Pan is stronger than those characters, and, like, in normal, thematic, real life...
Even what's interesting to me is Snow White. Snow White off weaker than all these other superheroes, but she can end up being the strongest out of all of them in the right conditions.
Because those damn dwarves.
Yeah, if you don't manage your realm really well.
Yeah.
Between that and the pickaxes and the wishing well and the everything.
Yeah. Just it's a balancing act for sure. I'm just trying to make sure like I said, it's just like based off the character and how you got your ally strength and how you're able to vanquish, how are those heroes' strengths matter towards like how you defeat stuff? And like you don't have to make it so Basil is weak compared to Simba because real life terms, a mouse definitely will be eaten alive by a real life lion. That is a thing.
Sure about that. I think it'd probably be pretty even.
Yeah, no, I think so too. one last note, and this is a pretty quick one, is all the fate decks are pretty half and half balanced, where it's half heroes, half items / effects.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. You pretty much always get 6-7 heroes, and then
the other half the other stuff.
Effects, items, general annoyances. You don't really see unique fate cards all that often. Because most of the time you don't really need them.
No, yeah, because they're all specific. You'll get a few repeat ones sometimes, but it's not that often. And even with the effect stuff too, like I think really the only one that stands out to me is On the Run. That's like the only one.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. I think that covers the engine though, Ditto. I think we did a pretty solid job of just trying to break all this down.
Give some people some help.
Yeah, no, for sure. I hope this was helpful, and I hope this is a really good episode for those of you who are listening.
Yeah, and if y'all ever heard anything in here that y'all want us to talk about again, let us know. Like,
oh yeah,
we'll talk about this all day. We can bring this up as many times as we want.
This has kind of been really fun because, like, you know, we both come from a little bit of a computer programming background, and it's kind of like I always tell people when you build out a tabletop game, it's very similar to building out a program where you have to put in
all these details.
Yeah, all these details.
Have exception handling.
Yeah. Exactly. But thank you all for watching. Thank you for all listening. For doing so much Twitch.
Too much stream.
Yeah, the words are in my brain. But until then, everybody, I hope you enjoy the episode. Stay healthy, stay safe, and as always, stay wicked.
Bye, guys.